We're beginning to understand the importance of water to the appearance of life on a planet. But how does water fit in when the planet itself appears? You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. I'm Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. We don't know for sure the exact prerequisites for life to arise, but for life on Earth, liquid water appears to be an essential requirement. But where did that water come from? Planet formation is an energetic and violent process, and both inside and out, there's a lot of molten rock involved. Lighter, more volatile molecules could reasonably be expected to boil off from an early Earth covered in a magma ocean. So how did the Earth come to be covered in water? Did the planet retain it somehow through its hot early stages? Or did it obtain it later, perhaps delivered to its surface by icy comets? Understanding how to make a watery Earth would tell us something about how common wet worlds are in the universe, and by extension, how common life may be. Dr. Lindy Elkins-Tanton asks these questions in her research. She's the director of the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism at the Carnegie Institution of Washington. There, she studies the formation and evolution of terrestrial planets, how they come together, and how their rocky components evolve and interact with their atmospheres. A key component of that is the role of volatile materials, water included. This year, she's a Mineralogical Society of America Distinguished Lecturer, presenting, in part, on the path water can take from the protoplanetary disk to the oceans of a terrestrial planet. I spoke to Dr. Elkins-Tanton recently about how to make a watery world, and what the latest science tells us about the potential to make planets like ours. So welcome to Western Worlds, Dr. Elkins-Tanton. And I gather that your work is involving the formation of planets and how we get water into small bodies in the solar system. So where does that story start?
Well, first, thanks very much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
That's great. So
where does that story start? Where does water come into planets? Traditionally, I think geochemists and people who studied meteorites thought for a long time that the Earth and the other planets accreted completely dry, as evidenced by their metallic cores, for example, because how could you have metal, iron metal, in contact with water? It would oxidize, and so planets had to have been made dry and then had water added later. But increasing evidence shows that water is added all through the process. And so in a historical sense, the story starts with the first people who thought about how planets might accrete. And in a solar system sense, I think it might start all the way back with dust in the protoplanetary disk.
Right.
Perhaps accreting water the way Mike Drake thought that it did.
Okay. How did Drake think so?
So he thought that water could be adsorbed onto the surfaces of tiny mineral grains or dust grains in the protoplanetary disk in the parts that were cool enough before they even accreted into larger bodies.
So there might have been water molecules in that solar nebula.
Yes, right. Traditionally, I think people have thought about the solar nebula or the protoplanetary disk in terms of an ice line, that inside of some distance away from the star, it was too hot for ice to condense into a solid, and so all the material inside of that line had to have accreted dry, and outside of it, it accreted wet. But even that story is too simple, because even very close to the star, there's an interior part of the disk that's shielded by dust in the early millions of years of the disk, where the interior shielded by dust could actually accrete water, or hydroxyl, or in the simplest case, even just a proton that could steal an electron, become a hydrogen, and then bond to some broken oxygen and become a hydroxyl.
Okay.
It's actually, when you look on the micro scale, and then as you build that up to the macro scale, it's incredibly hard to dry things out. water and hydroxyl are unbelievably persistent in solar system materials. And that ends up being the big story to my mind, that even as you go through every step of this process that should dry material, evidence is the material is never fully dried.
So when you said it was shielded by dust, is this just that there's so much dust that the sunlight can't get in and evaporate these
things?
That's
right. That's right. And so on average, beautiful studies show when you look at extra solar protoplanetary disks, the dust is gone on average by about 3 million years after the first solids are forming. And so within 3 million years, all of the material that's going to eventually grow to be planets has to have accreted into larger bodies because the dust is going to be blown out of the protostellar system or fall into the star. And so whatever water you want to have has got to be bound up in your rocky and icy materials by about 3 million years. And then goes the question of how do they accrete into larger and larger bodies, and do those increasingly energetic processes allow the growing planets to retain water, or are they dehydrated by these energetic processes?
So as they begin to accrete, what's the source of energy that would remove water? If it does.
Right. So in the very beginning, when you're just accreting tiny objects in the disk, probably they're sticking mostly by electromagnetic forces, and there isn't a lot of energy. And then there's this sort of mysterious stage that's worked on a lot by Anders Johansson and by others, trying to explain how you get from centimetric-sized bodies all the way to planetesimals, things that are tens to hundreds of kilometers in radius, because there's that size range where electromagnetic forces are not sufficient to stick things. At that point, they're not dust bunnies anymore. It's like bombarding two boulders together at some delta V, and they're not going to stick through EM forces, and they're not going to stick through gravity. And so Johansson and others have worked up a number of very intriguing macro processes, like big eddies in the disk that might crush the dust together. And probably none of those processes up to that point are too energetic. And so whatever water is bound into minerals probably remains.
Okay.
But then the big question becomes, can the water survive the following two highly energetic processes that have to go into making planets? The first one is the decay of the short-lived radioisotope aluminum-26, which apparently was very active in the first 1.5 to 1.7 million years of the solar system. So early, such a tiny slice of time. And yet it looks like many planetesimals, these tens to hundreds of kilometers radius building blocks of planets, were accreted in that time when there was this very hot, short-lived radioisotope. And we have evidence that these bodies could have been fully melted from the inside out by the heat of this radioisotope. And so the first question is, if you melt a planetesimal from the inside out, can it retain its water?
Right.
And then the second question is, as you bombard these things together in increasingly energetic giant accretionary impacts, can water survive those impacts? And you might guess that I think it can.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Well, we see in the real solar system that we live in, a lot of these bodies, at least in the inner, and I suppose in the outer solar system, have water on them.
Right.
So somehow they must have retained or recovered it.
That's right. That's right. And water on things can be misleading, of course, because you can obtain water on the surfaces of things the way we do on the moon, at least in part, from solar wind.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, can we prove that there was water deep inside these bodies that has been retained since accretion?
Okay.
And so one way to look at the first process, the aluminum-26 heating process, is to look at the library of meteorites that fall to Earth, because these are the fragments of the sad planetesimals that didn't get to accrete into planets, and instead they were smashed into bits. And, of course, the caveat is that most of the meteorites we get today come from the asteroid belt, not from the immediate planet-forming region. So they may not be the highest fidelity exemplars of what built our terrestrial planets.
Right.
However, there certainly is tremendous radial mixing during planetary formation. And so even Mercury must have obtained planetesimals from outside of Mars as it grew. And so I think they're probably not bad examples. And so looking at the library of meteorites, you can divide them into primitive meteorites that came from parent bodies, parent planetesimals that never melted.
Mm-hmm.
So they still have the iron metal and the silicates mixed on an intimate scale. And then you have the differentiated ones that come from bodies that did heat and form a metallic core and a silicate mantle like miniature Earths.
Right.
And so you measure those, you measure the silicate portion of those bodies, and they still have water in them. Just a tiny bit. Now, this isn't free water, of course, and it's not ice. It's water that's bound up into silicate minerals like serpentine or other kinds of hydrated silicate minerals. Mm-hmm. And so I've had people say to me, well, but we're talking about a tenth of a weight percent or 5/100ths of a weight percent. How can that possibly be enough? But if you took the entire hydrosphere of the Earth and you mixed it back into our mantle, it would only be about 250 parts per million of water by weight. So that's 0.02 weight percent.
Yeah, the Earth is mostly rock and metal.
The Earth is mostly rock and metal and just a tiny bit of water. And so in a simple back-of-the-envelope calculation, so if you build a planet from 1,000 parts per million of water, mm-hmm. something dry like a differentiated planetesimal, and you allow almost all that water to come onto its surface because only a little bit would be bound into the mantle minerals, it's just a volume to surface area problem. You can do it on the back of an envelope. It takes very little water in the giant volume of the Earth to cover its surface with water.
Right.
And so the first answer is planetesimals did carry sufficient water to make oceans on the Earth. And so then the next question is, can the Earth possibly have retained that water through the giant accretionary impacts that we know built it?
Okay. And I suspect you think that it can.
Right. I do. And I think that there's mission data, planetary mission data, that backs this up. So for decades, since 1970, when the first lunar rocks came back, people thought that the moon was completely dry, bone dry. And in fact, almost every hand sample of material we have back from the moon, every sample, has got metal in it, iron metal, showing that it was in a very reducing environment, very little oxygen activity to oxidize that metal. But then Alberto Sol in 2008 and his colleagues, Eric Howery and Jim Van Orman and Mac Rutherford, they measured the water contents of tiny volcanic glass beads that were erupted from a great depth in the moon, between 150 and 250 kilometers depth in the moon, and they found traces of water, tens to hundreds of parts per million of water. And in a 2011 science paper, they reported over 1,000 parts per million of water in these volcanic glasses from the moon. Now, this is interior water. It's not water from the surface. This is water that was obtained in the melting source region of the moon. And so there are parts of the moon, I would argue only small parts, but nonetheless parts of the moon that are as wet as parts of the interior of the Earth.
Right.
And that's revolutionary. And what that shows is that even the biggest accretionary impact that we know of, the one that produced the debris that re-accreted into our moon, did not fully dry that material. And so that, along with fantastic data both from Mars and from Mercury, amazingly, shows that none of our terrestrial planets was fully dried by giant accretionary impacts.
And it seems to be that the refuge for that water is bound up in the mineral crystals themselves.
That's right, bound up in the mineral crystals themselves. And so even as magma oceans on these young planets crystallize, the material that crystallizes out of them, your standard set of mantle minerals, perovskite and magnesia, wustite and garnet and olivine and pyroxene, all those familiar interior planet minerals, they all gather a little bit of water, tens of parts per million, maybe 100 parts per million. Just a few of them will take more than that. And the rest is released into the growing, hot, young atmosphere of that planet, and which then cools and collapses into a water ocean. And so we think it's not possible to fully dry planets. The really exciting outcome of this, or the implication, I think, is that exoplanets everywhere in the universe that grow from materials similar to our own would be expected to have water oceans early in their existence. Rocky planets everywhere. And whether that ocean persists or whether the hot steam atmosphere is blown away by an extra energetic young sun or whether it needs to be renewed, those are all questions, mm-hmm. and they would vary from planet to planet. But the exciting overarching point is it increases the chances of habitability of rocky planets everywhere in the universe tremendously by knowing that it doesn't require some stochastic process to deliver later wet material to the surface of the planet, because these rocky planets should be born with enough water to have their own oceans.
which is exciting. The implication being that, you know, wet planets are probably everywhere.
Are probably common.
Yeah.
That's right. And I do need to say that it's not that I don't think that later material is important. Clearly it is, and it absolutely had to have happened. Accretion goes on to the present day mm-hmm. on all of our planets, but it's not necessary to make a water ocean.
So if that may be a common way of making a planet, what about some of the exceptions? Are there planetary bodies where we don't see a thick silicate and water-rich shell around the core?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. This is something that's been especially highlighted by the excellent work of Eric Asfog and Bill Botke and some other people who do a lot of impact work in the early solar system. Some impacts early in the solar system are accretionary, the ones we've been talking about, but many of them are actually disruptive. And so that's one idea about maybe why Mercury has got such a gigantic core and compared to its thin, thin silicate mantle. Maybe it had disruptive impacts and parts of its mantle were removed. We're really interested in the end member of that process, which is the asteroid 16 Psyche.
Okay. What's special about this one?
16 Psyche is an asteroid in the outer main belt, and what's special about it is we think that it's a metal world. We think that it is the core of a planetesimal that's been stripped of its mantle through many impacts.
Okay.
The best spectra we have from Earth, the spectra done by Paul Harderson, show that it's perhaps 10% silicate on its surface and 90% iron nickel metal. This is the largest metal body in our solar system. There are a few other metal asteroids, but they're much smaller and they're distorted. This is the only body in the solar system that appears to be a naked core in
okay.
space. And so we're hoping to send a mission there to orbit it and see, for the first time in humankind's history, a metal world instead of a rocky or an icy world. And in the only way that we will ever be able to visit the core mantle boundary. We want to go see a metal world.
Right, because we could never get that far down inside the Earth.
We could never go there inside the planets that we live on from the outside, and we remain so curious about what this interior is really like. And here's a place we can actually go and see it.
Right on. And are there any guesses as to how this could have come about? Is it impacts or?
The most likely hypothesis, the one that we're working on, is that it's multiple impacts that stripped it off. This body is about the right size to be the core of the asteroid Vesta, for example. And so that's what we're looking at. And the thing we're really excited about is that if it was stripped that way, it's very possible that it had that it produced a magnetic core dynamo as it cooled from the outside in, from its very cold surface boundary condition. And if it cooled from the outside in with a core dynamo, its remnant magnetization would be preserved.
Oh, so you might be able to sense that.
That's right, exactly. So, of course, we'll fly a magnetometer if we get the chance. Mm-hmm. If you measure the magnetic strengths that are recorded in the iron meteorite samples we have on Earth, and then you see what kind of body they might have come from, they indicate that Psyche could have a magnetic field as strong as a large fraction of the Earth's, even though it's only 220 kilometers across. So it would be almost like a little fridge magnet in space.
Cool. Well, good luck trying to mount that mission, and I hope to hear about progress towards that.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
And thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So there's a buzzword in Mars exploration that we've had for a while, which is follow the water.
Yeah.
The idea that we're going to look for places where water has been so that we can understand the past of the planet and the potential for life. And Dr. Elkins Tanthan is obviously doing this in a very different way, following water through planet formation. And I think some of what she had to say really surprised me.
Yeah, me too, because I wouldn't expect water to survive the harsh environment of the debris disks, you know, like the collisions with fellow asteroids or debris and
high temperatures.
Yeah, right. High temperatures. And obviously then there's disk dynamics that goes on,
mm-hmm.
which obviously, you know, faster, closer to the star, slower, further away, expecting more collisions closer to the star. I would not expect, you know, water to survive something like that.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, like, I found it very, very interesting that it would survive through, you know, this formation process. I mean, I would expect it to evaporate,
mm-hmm.
basically, and I mean, we have seen water vapor, you know, near disks. That's not uncommon. Water vapor is seen even closer to black holes, like in the accretion disks, you can, like, there has been detection of water vapor. And that didn't surprise me, because I would assume, you know, it would evaporate. But, like, actually trying to find water in these, you know, rocky objects and have them survive over this long period of time, I still think we got water from comets.
It's possible, but...
Yeah, it's also surprising how much water is there available in the...
Mm-hmm.
Even before Earth is formed, there's water, there's that much water flowing around. And you think about it, like, the Earth has so much water, and then other planets such as Mars, which had water before, and also the moon of Jupiter, Europa, yeah, that also has water. So it's surprising that how much water is available in our solar system.
Yeah. Well, and Dr. Hawkins-Tanton mentioned at one point that... it's pretty easy to make water.
Yeah.
All you need is to start with hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's easy to, that's everywhere.
Yeah.
And all you need from after that is to find oxygen, which is
yeah.
also pretty common.
Yeah.
And hydroxyl is pretty easy to make. And next thing you know, you've got water or ionized water.
Yeah. I mean, they say the same thing for life too.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we have found amino acids in the space. Well, now we just need water.
And here, apparently, water is easy to get and hard to lose.
Yeah, yeah.
She says that it's basically impossible to dry out a planet.
Which actually is, I don't know, it doesn't seem to sink into me. Like,
yeah.
still, that, you know, that it would be hard to get rid of all the water. Like, I don't know, it's just, I just feel it's just not possible.
Yeah, well, she gave a lecture last week when she was here. Where she worked through the math, and she said, look,
mm-hmm.
if you have the expected composition of the materials that go into a planet, and then you dry them out by a factor of, you know, 10 to some fairly large power,
mm-hmm.
you still end up with a whole lot of water, enough for kilometers deep on the surface of the Earth, trapped in the minerals.
Yeah.
Right? Thermodynamically held inside the crystal structure of those minerals. And that argument seems to be well supported by these materials that they've pulled out from deep in the moon that have been brought to
yeah.
the surface, and they're hydrated.
Yeah, I mean, I think she talks about the fact that, like, you know, we didn't know water existed on moon,
mm-hmm.
and then there is water there, and then we do Mars, and, like, we expect, because we see all the features on Mars, we expect that at some point it had water.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go further beyond, and as you said, one of the moons of... the outer planets actually even have water. And you're like, all right, water is everywhere.
Yeah.
And then you expect, you know, obviously comets have ice, which we think if, you know, driven at high velocity, bump into some rocky planet, we would expect some kind of, you know, water to be generated. But I don't know. I still find it hard to
mm-hmm.
believe that, you know, this would exist over a long period of time.
Yeah.
I mean, I can understand how comets can have it because, you know, they're further away from star. It's easier, cooler there.
Mm-hmm.
Closer to the planet, I would find it harder. I mean, I think there were even talks about finding water on Mercury in some places where the sun really, like, it's always shadowed region.
They're pretty sure that they've seen radar detections
of water,
yeah.
Which surprises me because, you know, so close to the star,
yeah.
expecting water is not natural.
Yeah, well, and the surface of Mercury goes through some pretty serious temperature changes,
yeah.
except maybe in permanently shadowed areas.
Yeah.
But, you know, if Dr. Hawkins-Tanton is right that it gets incorporated into the planetary interior, that it comes back up from magnetism or whatever escaped to the surface, and that
mm-hmm.
it gets trapped in the minerals
yeah.
themselves. And we see that in asteroids and meteorites.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently we see it in samples from the moon. So if that's what happens, then, yeah, I guess I can believe that... planets would retain a lot of water through their
yeah.
formation process.
Yeah.
And if so, that's really cool, because it makes it sound inevitable that rocky planets are going to have a lot of water.
And if we can somehow extract that water, then we can space travel.
Well, that's true, yeah. It could be available for our use anywhere where there's rocky bodies.
Yeah.
But it also could be available for the use of life that arises on any rocky body.
Yeah, that's what I said, right? They found a lot of amino acids in space.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just throw it somewhere where there's water, well, yeah, you have life.
Yeah.
Right? But yeah, it's a good point that given that we are going into the space mining industry soon enough, finding water somewhere else would be, you know, maybe like at right now they think Mars is the next step. And then going beyond Mars, if human wants to go, let's say, beyond the asteroid belt, maybe picking one of the asteroid which has a lot of, you know, obviously materials that we need, that can be our base to the next step in the outer solar system. But this is obviously talking really, really long term.
Yeah, of course.
But yeah, I mean, studies like these would help us, you know, to predict whether we would expect things like that in the outer solar system or not.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, we expect most of these comets are coming from the outer solar system, right? They're fairly icy. And certainly, it's not just Europa. There's lots of icy moons.
Yeah.
And there's a whole session for that at the Big Planet Conference every year. So it's interesting to think just how many different ways water might get incorporated into different kinds of bodies throughout the solar system.
And, I mean, we have seen, have detected a lot of the comet material in the other debris disks. So it would not be uncommon to find water, you know, in those debris disks. I'm not sure if they have actually found one until now, but I know a lot of cometary kind of material has been seen in different debris disks. So if they say it's cometary, I'm assuming some kind of ice exists. And if that exists, that means water has been there for a long time, even through the debris disk phase, which, you know, she says should exist, should go through the whole phase and eventually still be there.
Yeah, it makes it sound like something that absolutely can and maybe has to happen. You know, that water being made up of relatively light elements that are, you know, hydrogen is the most common in the universe. Oxygen is part of some of the nucleosynthesis pathways in stars. So it should be all over the place. And if it can survive this complex and still not really understood process of planet formation, certainly we have one example of a planet with a big surface ocean.
Our own Earth.
That's right. And we've, you know, almost everywhere else in our solar system, we're finding hydrated minerals of some kind, and even significant amounts of water in icy shells of moons or massive ground ice in the Martian Arctic. So, you know, maybe it's water is a bit everywhere. And I guess really the question is just how does it go through these processes of planet formation? How does it get incorporated? What's the story? What's the pathway that it takes? And that whole process of planet formation we still don't really understand.
Yeah.
So trying to figure out Trying to piece together that history is a real challenge. But it's these arguments that she makes, I think, give us some hope that it's potentially very wet and very fruitful for early environments on these kind of planets.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Parshati Patel, Raymond Francis, and Zengi Hu. Our editors were Anna Noon and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can make world enough in time to join us again next week right here on astronomy.fm.